Welcome to Yacht Crew Vlogs, where we tell the stories of those in the yachting industry. A behind-the-scenes look that discovers the individuals in the industry, their history, their passions, and what inspires them to do what they do. Hi, everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of Yacht Crew Vlogs right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Rhea. I am your host, and today I'm really pleased to introduce Lou Sandoval. How are you?
Hi, Rhea. How are you? Doing very well here.
Good. Well, you have the distinction of being the first Hispanic Commodore in the Chicago Yacht Club's 145-year history.
Yeah, it's the club's been around a long time, since 1875.
And previously, has it been held by men and women, or...?
Mostly Caucasian men. And so I'm the first Hispanic in that respect. Currently on our flag, we just elected, we elected and they started their term in January. Our vice commodore is a female. She's a past judge. And then our secretary is a female. So we have two women on our flag. So, and then the current commodore is a male. So, you know, figure, after this Commodore, we'll have a female Commodore. She will be the first.
Good. Well, it's nice to see a few things changing. But before we get into change, because I do want to talk to you a lot about change, actually. Tell me a little bit about yourself. I mean, you've been in the biotech industry, concierge service, boat broker, dealer. Where were you born and raised, and what got you into yachting?
You know, it's funny. I was born in Chicago. I mean, I'm a native Chicago, and I like to say I did the circle tour of the United States, vis-a-vis. But I started out on the south side of Chicago. Grew up in a working class neighborhood. You know, my dad was a steel worker, and my mom was a homemaker, but effectively ran the house. And so I had the benefit of having a stay at home mom in that respect. I'm the oldest of four. Grew up, like I said, in a working class neighborhood. I was exposed to sailing kind of on a whim. I was invited once to go join a Boy Scout troop at our school. And as part of that, we went to summer camp. And at summer camp is where I learned to sail out in Michigan. You know, we used to go in the summers out to a little lake that's just off of Muskegon, Michigan, up north, Big Blue Lake. And that's where they had sailing classes. And as part of my sailing merit badge, I learned to sail on a sunfish. Just never thought about it at all. Kind of did it, got the merit badge and route to Eagle and to my Eagle Award, and never just did much with it, except for when I started in my professional career afterwards. I started getting asked, hey, listen, we're going sailing. I ended up joining colleagues to go sail at J-24s out of Waukegan Harbor. And so it became a way for me to build rapport. And I think that's important because, when you grow up in a community where you don't have sailing, or you don't grow up in a yacht club, or you don't grow up in those types of privileges and comfort, when you get into the work world, you don't know how to relate to your colleagues sometimes. And, you hear them, we went off to the yacht club, we went off sailing, and you're like, well, that must be nice. I've never done that before. But I did. I had sailed. So I took, I'm always kind of an adventurous person. I said, yeah, sure, I'll join you guys. So I started kind of getting my feet wet with that. And then my career took me out to Seattle started getting involved in the sailing community out there. And then, developed a concierge service out of that because, I saw a need in talking to clients. This is kind of a side hustle. We saw a need with clients that they had they're these boats in the harbor and they weren't using them, and it's a year round maintenance opportunity up there because they're in salt and brackish water. And I was already sailing. So I got together some vendors and, put together a business model, and I approached a couple of them and said, hey, listen, if I'm able to, provide for the care of your boat, provide for, a crew when you need it and have the boat provision and take care of all the maintenance, would it be worth X to you per month? And they're like, certainly. So that's kind of where that started. And in doing that, I got the opportunity to use their vessels for personal use, obviously with crew and them. And sometimes I take it out with them, to help them entertain. And occasionally I had a couple customers that were in a competitive sail racing, offshore racing. And with those customers, I was able to, you know, set up their program, and I did 2 Transpac races, which is the race from LA to Honolulu. And then I did 1 Victoria Maui race, which is from your neck of the woods, from Victoria, BC, out to Maui, and a couple new Newport Gents and Ensenadas up and down the coast. So I got a chance to sail the Pacific Ocean. And then when my life took me to, my career took me, I should say, to Miami, I then now had more responsibility. So I kind of sold that business in Seattle to one of my vendors, sub-vendors, and he kind of rolled it up into a marine dealership a little later. Became an equity partner in that. But on my end, in Miami, now I'm busy with my full-time job, and I've got more responsibilities, and I have colleagues that were reaching out to me, you know, I should say customers, people that I knew in the sailing community reaching out to me saying, hey, I heard you did this for so-and-so who I went to medical school with. So I'm kind of wondering if you would want to do this here. And at first I said, no, I don't want to, my day jobs keep me plenty busy, but you know, I'm always an entrepreneur. I'm always looking for additional revenue streams for different things. So eventually I said, you know what, I had the business model. I have some contacts, so let me kind of cobble it together. And I already had the formula. So I rolled it out again and did the same thing. And, you know, then we started doing the same thing. You know, I did a Newport to Bermuda. I did a Havana Cup, and I did a lot of the SORC racing down in the Southeast. So now I got the chance to sail in the Atlantic, although I haven't crossed the Atlantic yet, which is kind of a goal of mine still. You know, to be able to cross the big pond, but that kind of gave me the opportunity to do that in the Miami proper area. And then obviously again, my career took me back to Chicago to the corporate headquarters. So I exited that business down in Miami, came back. Now I've got more responsibility in Chicago, and the opportunity came up to buy a little ugly 26-foot yellow sailboat with some friends from high school and my brother. So the four of us went in on a $7,600 boat, you know, cheap boat, ugly yellow, banana yellow. We named it Chiquita after the bananas. Yes. And our logo even was a knockoff on the Chiquita, you know, logo. No, hope there's no attorneys listening, but it was kind of funny. We kind of put the outline of the city of Chicago in the logo, and that was our boat. You know, here you got four bachelor guys, kind of did a lot of bonding and a lot of sailing for the summers that we had it, but as we started to, you know, put more money into that boat, we're like, hey, listen, this boat's getting older. The bills are getting bigger. And, you know, we're not going to, you know, we're not getting ahead on this thing. We're starting to lose money. So, you know, we started looking at buying a new boat, and we researched brands. We researched a lot of different brands and came upon the Beneteau brand. Was very impressed with them, the fit, you know, and the make of the boats and the way they were made. It was there's a prolific dealer here in Chicago who's known as the legend, Joe Darby. And Joe and Elaine were the dealers for Darfin Yachts. They were one of the first 3-4 dealers that brought the brand to North America in the 80s. And Joe, you know, Joe's an affable gentleman, full of a lot of stories. But they ran basically a mom and pop shop out of the basement of their house with the, you know, boats in the boatyard and the like. And, you know, my experience in buying the boat was interesting because they did everything they could to not sell me a boat, including not returning my phone calls, you know, not showing up to, you know, to show me the boat. So, I mean, I'm like, and I wanted, we're ready to buy the boat. We had already done our work. We've been qualified to buy the boat. And they just, you know, that's how they were, you know, so we eventually bought the boat, and, you know, and I thought to myself, wow, if these guys have about a 25% market share and they're doing what they do to, you know, kind of scare customers away, pursuing business in an aggressive fashion, you know, you'd be a phenomenal success. So I, you know, kind of put that thought on the side and started sailing the new boat and the likes. And, you know, we developed a friendship with I developed a friendship with the Darbys. They started asking me to come work boat shows with them, you know, my free time on the weekends and the like. And before you know it, I decided to, you know, to kind of go and be their, be their sales guy. And then I learned that they wanted to sell the business, and that opened the conversation to, you know, to buy the business. And so for 15 years ran the business and, you know, took the business from basically the bottom third of the country in North America to the top three. To the top three, we went in market share from 25-ish% market share to just under 50, about 52% market share. So we bought double the market share, became the number three dealer in North America. And we did it primarily on customer service, on making sure. So the one thing that I noticed that was their weakness, we obviously modernized a lot of the processes of the business, but we did it on the customer experience. We made sure that the selling of the boat was the minimal part. That's the introduction to the relationship. But on customer service, that we focused on exactly making sure that their experience was wonderful, that, you know, that when they had a problem with the boat, that it was addressed in a reasonable fashion, that they, you know, that they got, you know, top-notch service, that their experience the day they took delivery of the vessel was memorable. You know, we would do a red ribbon, we do a red carpet, you know, on the dock, and, you know, we'd give them a gift basket with their favorite wine or champagne or spirit, cigars, you know, just different things that would make it memorable for them. And that won us, you know, 100% CSI, customer service index, customer satisfaction index from NMMA. And that was the cornerstone of our business proposition, you know, is excellent customer experience. And so that's kind of how we grew it. And then obviously being in our 30s and our late 30s during that period of time, a lot of the people that we were, you know, surrounded by were in that age range. So we really brought the median age down during that period of time during our, you know, with a lot of our contemporaries, because a lot of them were like us, double income, no kids, or they're double income with kids, you know, one child or like, and they wanted to kind of take on boating. So we attracted a lot of, you know, they say likes attract likes, you know, and that attracted a lot of our you know, contemporaries. So we brought the median age down significantly of ownership in the Lake Michigan area. So that was great. And so did that for 15 years and then pivoted, you know, exited that business. You know, my business partner left in 2016, and then I ran the business for another year, and then found an opportunity to kind of exit the business. And as I was looking at what was next, you know, I was looking at a couple of different opportunities, you know, marina management, marina ownership, you know, pivoting, you know, in the different sector of the marina. Those didn't pan out for one reason or another. And then I got a call from a mentor saying, hey, listen, there's an opportunity with this company that they're thinking of bringing a product digitally. And, you know, you seem to be the right person for the job. So kind of did my background work. And, you know, before you know it, I was being asked to, you know, kind of help build this brand. And we put together a team of six people that were very efficient and in doing, you know, bootstrap. Imagine this with corporate funding. We did this outside of the corporate umbrella as a startup. And with six people, we were able to do what divisions full of 5,000 people can't do. You know, we built a brand. We marketed it. We created created brand presence and depth and engagement with the customers, and basically added legitimacy to a category that was non-existent prior. I mean, the closest competitor had been in the market for 10 years, and they had kind of, you know, they had been the first to market, but, you know, they were again privately funded, and, you know, they through three iterations of their component. They really they hadn't garnered more than about 3,000 users, you know, and that's self-reported. So that question's like, you know, how much was actually there, you know. So our entry into the market helped legitimize the category, and just in an easy, you know, just in on the internal brands that company that Brunswick represented, you know, we were able to kind of, you know, match if not double double the number of boats that they had in circulation. So that brand continues to today. I exited that opportunity in October of this past year, and the next chapter is being written. So I'm not going to steal the thunder on that, because there'll be an announcement very soon. But the next chapter of my life is being written. There's some exciting news that'll be released here very shortly. So, but
we're excited.
Life takes us in many different directions, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, during the twists and turns, during the different tacks of our life, we just got to keep our eyes on the mark, and understand that we're eventually going to get around that mark, you know. So,
well, you know, one thing that I wanted to talk to you about was marketing and service. It sort of comes together in one in this case, for the simple fact that North America is really well known for its service. In some cases, especially in the States, because there's some places that unless you give good service, you don't get paid a penny. So service is sort of first and foremost. That's kind of how you make a living. When it comes to marketing, what is going on in the yachting industry? are they missing a marketplace that is out there that has huge money that they could be tapping into but aren't?
You know, it's a good question, Rhea. You know, I'm of the opinion that, you know, I think the United States does a good job at a certain level of customer service, you know, the customer experience. I think in the dealer distribution channel, the top, you know, say maybe 20% of the dealers get it because they're either large conglomerates or corporately owned, or they have the resources, which I think is the primary definition of that. They have the resources to create that, you know, some of them through their coverage have the ability to do that. Others through the resources they have are able to deliver on a good customer experience. But I think what's challenging the industry right now is this influx of new boaters that have come in, many of which don't have a background in boating, has created a greater demand for a better customer experience. And good isn't going to cut it to keep these boaters in, because these boaters come with expectations from how they bought their car, how they recently searched for their home and financed it, you know, how they bought their refrigerator or how they bought their, you know, their computer, or especially during this pandemic, the touchless experience that they've had with various retail businesses. So in many cases, ordering online and having the product delivered to the curbside, you know, and that includes large assets, you know, titled assets like cars. So that experience is changing. You know, I think for those companies that invested in a digital platform, they shot ahead in this pandemic economy. Those that didn't, it's time for them to get with it really quick, because they're going to be left behind. This digital transformation has been shoved to the forefront during the pandemic. So it's going to be very important for them to get on board with that. But more importantly, and let's get back to the part about the new buyers coming into the market. You know, 10 years ago, we got together in the Recreational Boating Council. And, you know, it's 150 professionals from across the industry. And we looked at the problems at the back end of the recession. What was keeping people out of boating? And the problems are some of the ones that are very familiar today. Lack of access, lack of perception of what boating is, cost, education. And obviously, the outreach to groups that don't already participate in boating. And we had a demographer come to speak to us at that point in time. This is 2011 now. Speak to us about the demographic trends in the United States. And he very clearly put a couple graphs up, which I remember were pivotal. You know, Caucasian population, flat to declining, forecasted over the next 10 years. By 2025, I think was his number. African-American community, flat to declining. Obviously, smaller family units, et cetera. Asian population, upward growth. Hispanic population, upward growth. And in both of those two latter categories, the Asian and the Hispanic demographic, younger populations, younger families. So the potential for growth was even larger. And then, so when we look at the market today, you know, when we look at the multicultural, and then specifically the multicultural market, the marine industry is really behind on that. Consumer brands, the Frito-Lays of the world, the Pepsis of the world, the McDonald's of the world, the Apples of the world, have all gotten what multicultural marketing is about. We're in the dark ages in the boating industry. We still show most of the media that we do, still shows the collateral, shows mostly white people using boats, mostly white young people using the boats. And that's great because that's the target demographic, but you know, that's in it today. But if we continue to just market to who's in it today and don't start to think about the future, they're going to be selling the last or the second to last boat. And in 5 to 10 years, we'll be pretty much, you know, out of a market base. So I think it's important at this point in time for the marine industry to look at that $3.9 trillion in buying power for the multicultural market. And that's from the CELIC, from a CELIC study that was published by the University of Georgia. And in that $3.9 trillion, the majority of that is a Latino consumer. Second largest is the Asian consumer. And then the African-American consumer is in that as well. So that's what makes up that $3.9 trillion in buying power.
Yeah, I think the Black American was $100 billion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The number that I found. The question that I have, though, I mean, actually, the $100 billion was on luxury travel alone. Mm-hmm. That was on travel. So, I mean, you can qualify boating and yachting as luxury travel. How much of this disposable income do you think could be allocated to the boating market that isn't at the moment?
Well, just let's get outside of what people perceive those communities to be, okay? Because Hollywood does, and I'd say there's a lot of factors in play here, because Hollywood does a really good job of portraying us. We had this conversation in the Sandoval House a lot. Hollywood portrays that Hispanics as domestics, laborers, drug cartel leaders, gangbangers. You know, that's how Hollywood portrays us. And I'm not saying that, you know, laborers and domestics are not, you know, an admirable profession. They're honest, you know, hardworking individuals. My parents were in that category. So as my second generation gets in this and we become lawyers, doctors, entrepreneurs, business people, that story is not being told. So there's this perception. And then you get us inside of corporate America and people don't understand us because they don't understand that we are a low-key type person. We don't always advocate for ourselves as we should. And they have a tough time really understanding how we fit in. And all this talk about diversity and the George Floyd movement and everything, people forget our struggle in the Latino community is huge. And because, I mean, we have less than a 4% representation on corporate boards. In corporate America, we have a minuscule 3.2% representation. So how are we going to end up in corporate boards if we're not even making it to the EVP, SVP level? You know, there's no pipeline. And that in itself is a problem with corporate America. And they don't understand. I think they want to understand, but they don't. I mean, I'm a classic example. Why am I no longer in my former company? You know, why wasn't there an opportunity there? You know, that is a question that a lot of people are asking. And, you know, Latino Corporate Directors Association recently published something in Bloomberg that really looks at the why and the need for a pipeline and the fact that diversity includes Latinos and the fact that diversity includes Asians and the fact that diversity includes African-Americans. It's not just what happened in California when they the government mandated that boards had to have, you know, companies in California had to have diverse boards. And a year later, they find that most of the people that benefited from diverse positions were Caucasian females. That's just a left pocket, right pocket shift. They really didn't dig deep into where are the Asians, where are the Hispanics, where are the African Americans. So
for me, I sort of see that as an oxymoron, as it were, because diversity is diversity and equality is equality. Right. For me, equality is women and men equal, and diversity mm-hmm. is minority, right. Whatever persuasion, whether it be religion, whether it be color, whether it be race, whatever. But for me, those are two different things entirely. So if a corporation has a mandate to say that we have to have a more diverse board, I would assume that didn't mean Caucasian women at right. all.
I'll put it to you this way. Here's the framework that I like to think of it. And I kind of said this in other arenas, and I'm borrowing this from a colleague that actually, I heard her say it first, but so it's not original at all. I don't claim ownership to it, but diversity is welcoming everybody in to the party. Okay. Equity is making sure that everyone has a seat at the table. Okay. I mean, everyone across all cuts. Okay. And inclusion is making sure that everyone is having fun at the party. And all three of those together, and that's why you see the term now being used. It's not D&I, it's DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's really what needs to happen. Not only from, you know, internally inside businesses, but you look at, you know, how companies are sourcing suppliers and how are they creating net worth for diverse minority-owned businesses and women-owned businesses, are they bringing them in as suppliers? And are they giving them opportunity? Are they sharing the wealth? Or is it just a good old boys club? Do I take care of the people that look like me? And those are suppliers. That's another component. And then the last component is how are we addressing the market that's out there, that $3.9 trillion? Are we trying to sell to them like we sell to any other consumer? Because remember, some of these people don't have a history in boating. So how are we fine-tuning our business? You know, how are we making it more inclusive? And I'll tell you, I was in a recent, a seminar for the Latino Leadership Summit for Hispanic Stars in December. And they had some leaders in the consumer products industry. Consumer products gets it. They have Latino product directors or Latino marketing VPs that are actually building marketing plans specific for the target demographic. And why? Because they buy differently. They approach the market differently. They look at things differently than the average consumer. So it's like, you know, in pharma, we used to say when we were diversifying pharma in the 90s, when I was there, we would say our doctors are Asian, they're Black, they're Hispanic, and we saw it early on. So therefore, our sales forces have to look like them, because how can you be culturally aware and stand sit across the table from a customer and try to engage them if you don't know and you say things that don't make them feel included, you know? So we early on in the pharma industry started to, you know, we were pumping diversity before it became a thing. You know, I mean, my colleagues, the teams that I built in the pharma industry were as diverse as the United Nations, African-American, women, you know, I mean, you name it. And that's obviously for me, that was always, you know, a hallmark. And I tried to make as diverse a team as possible, but that is exactly what it takes to be successful in that industry. So there's a lot of things that corporate America can learn from that approach as well.
Well, and I mean, not even just corporate America. The fact is, if we bring it over to
the marine industry. Yeah, the marine
industry. You know, the marine industry as a whole, we as people, when we look at something, we're attracted to something that reminds us of us or who we want to be or who we aspire to be. And when you look at yachting, I'm sorry, it's just white old men. You know, I mean, it really is.
Or white old women, which is the same thing. Yeah.
Or 20-year-old women with the white old man. Do you know what I mean? You see a ton of young women in bikinis, and you see these old men on the yachts and whatever. And that's 30 years ago. I mean, the research that I've done lately, you see that the average person that can afford to purchase a yacht, the average new millionaire billionaire, is 48 years old, has been married for 10 years, has 3 kids. That's who we should be marketing to.
And it's a segmentation too, because as you're speaking of the yachting industry, which is there, I fully agree with you. You look at the number of people that have gone into tech startups, you know, .com businesses, and they've exited and come out with millions, you know, those individuals now are in that category of, you know, I want more experiences, more luxury items. So how do you bring them on? They're more diverse, they're more inclusive, but Let's go down a notch, because there's segmentation in boating, you know. So you're talking about the tip of the pyramid, but in the middle, you know, those $100,000 to $200,000 boats, you know, there's people that again, lawyers, attorneys, doctors, professionals that are very diverse, and then you get down into the broadest part of the pyramid, you know, the entry level boats, the 24-foot and down, which is the largest segment. Yeah. The average boat buyer, and NMMA has these statistics. The average boat buyer in that range, in the bottom of the pyramid, makes less than $100,000 or less a year. So those are the ones buying your aluminum fishing boats, your pontoon boats. That's where the families are coming in. And think of that pyramid. It's now a sales funnel, because the more you're putting into the pyramid, into the funnel, the more is coming out of the top. If they stay, and the big goal is to turn lifelong boaters, you know, to create lifelong boaters. You know, and that is the real focus. I know that's our focus at Chicago Yacht Club in the attraction and the creation, all the programming that we have created, you know, the experience that we created from the pandemic to be able to look at a really huge operating revenue deficit in Q2 and to create a unique experience for all of our members. So they came out and they sold the club out night after night that we were open, you know, and they came and they utilized the facilities. I mean, we're going to close the year out in the black. And why? Because we focused on the experience. We also launched a touchless app during that period of time, which created contactless ordering. You know, we created, you know, throughput in all of our major on the water activities, you know, our sonar fleet, our, you know, all the different components, our sonar fleet, our women's on the water program, which was, you know, my wife led up and just brought in, it was oversubscribed. Women were, they wanted to get in. I mean, we ran a full Friday session and they were eating it up. And I think this year's going to be just as big as well.
Well, you know, what's really interesting, you know, when you talk about boating, the fact is, I remember as a kid growing up, I think we started with a rubber dinghy and then we got canoes. And then my father graduated to aluminum fishing boats. And then he got a bigger fishing boat and a bigger fishing boat. And I think his last boat was a 32-foot Bayliner, which he could overnight on. He could actually go cruising with. And if he actually knew how to drive that boat, he might have gotten a bigger one. But as it stood, every time he took it out, he would bang into another boat. So insurance got too expensive, so we had to sell it. But take your captain's license.
There you go.
But, you know, you're right. You know, the fact is you instill a love of boating at the small end of the scale, and that will grow. So as these people, not only their incomes rise, but they get older as well. You know, they might go out and buy themselves a canoe at the age of 21 years old because that's what's in their price range. By the time they're 35 or 40 years old, they may be able to get into the yachting category.
Right.
So to start hitting them now and marketing to them now, you said a quote just the other day that really stuck home to me. Do you remember what that was?
No, no, no. Refresh my memory. I do. You know me. I do a little bit of talking. So
you can't build boats and market product to yesterday's customer.
Yeah, that's true. And it's kind of what I was talking about, building the boat to the person that's buying their second tour, their last boat. Because what that means is that basically in 5 to 10 years, you're going to end up with a bunch of big boats that have no pipeline to buy from, you know, that you don't have a pipeline of buyers for. And you know, there's another statistic that came out recently. It came out this summer during a lot of the turmoil that we saw in our country. And it was in a study by the Brookings Institute. And that in the year 2021, the Caucasian sector of North America is, it's the first year that in the age range below 25, they're actually the minority. You know, in every major state around the country, they've had a downward population trend for Caucasians. So what's growing? Asians, Hispanics, African-Americans. So we're going to be a mostly diverse, multicultural world. And then so as much as my wife would say, you know, we want our daughters to marry, you know, another Hispanic, but, you know, the truth of the matter is the more they're in this world of diversity, I don't know who they're going to marry, if they marry, or they may not marry at all, you know, honestly. And I mean, that's another trend too. You know, you don't need to be married.
Don't get married and don't have kids.
Don't have kids. You'll have see experiences, but you know, the more successive generations go on, the more multicultural and the more ingrained and mixed things become. So now the multiculturalism is going to be embedded in the consumer that may not identify with being X, Y, or Z. They might just say, generation 3.0 might just say, hey, I'm a buyer. Understand me. And so if we don't start to get that in the marine industry today and start to position for that, and you know, and there's a lot of smart people in marketing of large corporations in the marine sector, but I think what they're missing the boat on, and pun intended, is they are missing the boat on how to address the multicultural market segments. That there are insights that they can get from other consumer products companies that are doing it, and they're doing it very well. The Frito-Lays of the world, the PepsiCos of the world, even the IBMs of the world.
I think too, though, it's a matter of research. Like, is nobody doing research? I really don't understand that, because if I can spend, you know, every day, all day, you know, doing my research as an individual, like you said, these big companies, they have huge marketing departments and they throw a lot of money towards marketing. Do they not have a research department because the numbers are there?
I think they have research departments, but their bias is they have implicit bias, you know, because they don't have diverse teams making those decisions. How diverse? And just being female is not diverse enough. It addresses the gender part of it. Yeah. But how many African Americans do they have in their senior management team making those decisions? How many Hispanics do they have in those senior management teams making? And are they even letting them get to the level where they can make those decisions? You know, because in most cases it's headphones on, blinders on. You know, and you could be the smartest, most educated, you know, executive in the world, and yet be tone deaf to what a multicultural buyer is really looking for.
Well, I mean, the fact is, if you're not marketing to the multicultural buyer, you're not even going to get them in the door to find out what their wants or needs are anyway. And I think, you know, boating and yachting are making a huge mistake right now in not targeting that demographic as a whole.
I think I think they border on extinction if they don't address it, because, you know, here's what's coming after this pandemic. So after people kind of start to, the vaccine makes its way around and people start to, you know, sort of resume their normal life. And I say sort of, because I know what the conversation's been in the Sandoval household is, do we really miss driving around from soccer game to soccer game? Do we really miss that hustle bustle life we had before, where we're going from event to event to event? And at the end of the week, we're just exhausted. And I think a lot of people have put the big pause on and they said, hey, how much of that do we want back? And I think boating is one thing that they may want back, because it allows you to connect. Yeah. It really allows you to connect, to deepen. I mean, I love the time in the car with my daughters to drive them to soccer games or to different events, because we get a chance to talk. But we have a lot more conversations on the boat. We have a lot more experiences we share. Sunsets, sunrises, you know,
well, and to be absolutely honest, if you go far enough out, there's no Wi-Fi, so that takes care of that too, right?
And that takes care of that as well, right? And that's where I think, that we have to be careful on what technology we put there. Is it technology that enables our engagement of boating, or is it technology that, you know, further complicates it, you know? And I think that there's that call. I mean, I'm a big tech fan, you know, and I love technology, but I also know the dark side of it. So I'm very sensitive to that. And we have, you know, we use our smartphones on the boat to take pictures, because that's what captures the experience in the moment. But, you know, the kids aren't using those. They put them in the cubby holes down below, and we sail and we sit and we watch and we breathe the air and we experience it. Our dog comes with us. We have fun with the dog on the boat. You know, it's just, it is what it is. You know,
I think what has happened during this pandemic is that people have realized how important being together really is, and mm-hmm. how, even though you were together for the longest time, you were so busy doing other things, or everybody was on their own device, that you actually didn't spend that time. And, you know, boating is one of those ways that I think people are reconnecting with their family members, even though they live in the same house. It's the only time that they actually get together and have a conversation, because at home they don't. And you saw a huge increase in the U.S. in boat sales and yacht sales this past year throughout the pandemic. I think it was 50% or around
huge
about.
Huge numbers. Yeah, huge numbers.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, you know, that is a trend. And if that trend continues, then there is going to need to be a way for, like you said, the top of the pyramid to tap into that marketplace.
Right. Well, and I think it's addressing the customer pain points in the experience of ownership too, because on the back end of this, you know, we still haven't solved the workforce problem in boating. You know, we don't have enough seasoned professionals in the trades to address, you know, diesel mechanics, you know, to be diesel mechanics, to be at the dealership level, to be HVAC, technicians, you know, all the different specialties. So, because when something goes wrong with the boat, can we use technology to identify it? Yes. But do we still need somebody that needs to go out there and fix it? And like everything else, you know, the American society has really put a price on going to college, and we've put away a lot of what it takes to go out and earn a trade, and you pretty much be employable the minute you're done getting your trade certificate. And that's where I think workforce development needs to take place. And I think the marine industry is a great opportunity for workforce development of diverse communities as well. Bringing them in, teaching them, again, this is, you know, the three different ways, consumer, to create diversity, equity, inclusion at the consumer end, at the employee end, and this is vertically as well as, you know, horizontally, and then at the supplier end. Are we creating wealth at those? Those are three pieces of the puzzle. You know, are we giving our corporations, our marine companies, sharing their wealth with diverse communities? Because I know from my different junctures and different opportunities that people, they appreciate when somebody understands them. That's the inclusion part, empathy, you know, empathy. And there's a thing in design thinking, which, you know, coming out of Brunswick, there's a colleague there is a big disciple of design thinking, Paul Siebert, and I love the guy. But, you know, design thinking and how you design products comes out of customer empathy. And I would argue that design thinking needs to be applied to marketing, and empathy needs to be applied to how we design our marketing plans.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This has been a fascinating conversation, as every single time that I speak with you. You are definitely an inspiration to many, and a source of great knowledge to be honest. I mean, I learn every single time I talk to you, I learn something new.
No, I mean, I'm a savant like that, I guess. My wife teases me all the time. She's like, you're like, is there anything you don't understand? I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of things I don't understand, and you know them, but, you know, I get ribbed a lot about that here in the Sandoval household. But I mean, more than anything, I think I'm a collection of experiences, and that's what my life's about. And I try to apply those experiences to everything that I do. And like I said, I'm excited to be able to kind of release what my new news is here very shortly. But, you know, I'm that's going to
benefit from my experiences. I can tell you're excited because you've mentioned it twice now. You're like, I want to tell you. Yeah. Well, you know what? You're going to have to come back when you do have your new news, and you'll have to come back and let us hear the story.
Well, when you play this in reverse, this you'll see the little things that I've dropped some Easter eggs for you in the conversation. So when we put it back, the next time I come back, you'll be like, you were tipping me off. All right, but we'll leave it at that.
We are definitely going to have you back. Thank you ever so much again for your time, Leo. I know you're a busy man. You've got a family to look after and other business to do. So best of luck. And we're going to be waiting with bated breath to hear what's coming up for you next.
All right. Thank you, Rhea. And I appreciate it. I wish you lots of luck with the channel. And any way that I can help you, you just let me know. All right.
Thank you so much. Once again, Lou Sandoval. He is the first Hispanic Commodore of the Chicago Yacht Club in its 145-year history. He has now finished that and on to bigger and better projects in the future. And we will stay in touch with him to let you know what's up next for him. You've been watching another edition of Yacht Crew Vlogs right here on Yachting International Radio. My name is Rhea. I have been your host. Please tune in again for another episode.